From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs from 2007 to 2009. Mary Beth Long has the distinction of being the first woman confirmed in this capacity, which is the civilian equivalent of a four-star military post. She has worked directly with Secretaries of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Robert Gates. Mary Beth Long led the International Security Affairs Office in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, responsible for policy for the Middle East, Europe, and Africa. She was also the first woman ever to be appointed as chair of NATO's high-level group, the highest level responsible for NATO's nuclear policy and reporting directly to the Secretary General of NATO. Mary Beth Long recently served as a senior advisor to NATO on irregular warfare and hybrid threats and provided the Department of Defense with support on the Middle East, Afghanistan, and threat financing. Earlier in her career, Long served as an operations officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA. A native of Clearfield, Pennsylvania, Long was a top honor student as an undergraduate at Penn State University. Mary Beth Long also graduated cum laude with a JD from Washington and Lee University School of Law. I met Secretary Long at a recent meeting of LCWINS, the Leadership Council for Women in National Security, where she spoke alongside Ukrainian Ambassador to the United States, Oksana Markarova, about the best ways to support Kyiv as it defends its national sovereignty and serves as a bulwark for the transatlantic alliance against Russian tyranny. I was greatly impressed by her views on so many issues critical to U.S. national security, as well as the fact that she is from my home state of Pennsylvania. So it is my great pleasure to welcome a fellow Pennsylvanian, the Honorable Mary Beth Long, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, to Press Conference USA. And she joins us via Zoom. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. You know, when I was deployed abroad with CIA, Voice of America was a really, really important part of our daily routine. So I'm privileged and proud to be not only associated with VOA, but with you, Carol, the consummate professional.
Well, you're too kind, and thank you so much. Mm-hmm. So, Mary Beth, you served at the Pentagon under George W. Bush. You are the first woman as Assistant Secretary of Defense. And I'd like you to reflect on the challenges that you faced then, national security challenges, and looking to today as we face a revanchist Russia having just reinvaded Ukraine and an aggressive authoritarian China?
That's a great question. I think it's really important to step back and take a look at the juxtaposition of those two things. I was there during the U.S. military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And while much of the world had arguments with us and did not agree with us about a lot that was going on, particularly in those two places, the one thing I think that the U.S. had that we do not enjoy now, and that is a reputation for doing what we say, saying what we do, and a certain ability to shape, if not project, our power globally. That is very different than the case today. And there are really three reasons for that. But right now, I see U.S. military and U.S. political power waning on the global stage.
So you see our political and military power waning on the global stage. What reasons do you provide for that waning power?
I think there are a lot of reasons, but there are three primary reasons. The first is the perception, if not the reality, that U.S. politics and the U.S. foreign policy, U.S. national security policy, U.S. national military ability is confused, chaotic, and unpredictable. We're not reliable. It's a perception problem as a result of our probably the better part of a decade of not saying what we will do and then doing what we say. We've been very erratic. Secondly, the world has changed, and a lot of the countries and regions have become much more independent and much more globalized so that they cannot pursue, it's very difficult for them to pursue one line of foreign policy and trade that is closely aligned to the U.S. And the Middle East is a perfect example where the Middle East countries, and the region has really come into its own. It's a banking center of the world. It's a tourist center of the world. They're sending people into space, and that makes foreign policy, trade, and military policy for them much more complicated than the days when we were in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then thirdly, there's the rise of the global South. And I think the U.S. sees both allies, potential partners, and even adversaries with feet in multiple camps at the same time. With globalization, trade with China is even more important than I think many people anticipated. Yet the U.S. and China are at odds, but we can't expect and shouldn't expect partners, allies, and even adversaries to choose between us and China. Russia is big time disruptor in the global sphere on the one hand. On the other hand, we've seen a lot of the world not want to publicly antagonize President Putin. So multiple feet in multiple camps, and that has a direct impact on the U.S.'s ability to act unilaterally or even in concert with a lot of our traditional allies.
Well, that's a terrific summary, Mary Beth Long. And I know you're not saying that when you served, for example, when Iraq and Afghanistan were front and center, that we didn't make any mistakes back then. Certainly, we know that former President Bush was criticized for having led this invasion of Iraq on what many people thought were false premises, having turned his sights away from Afghanistan. But having said that, let's look at the Biden administration. How do you see the Biden administration managing the many challenges that you spoke about?
Carol, you hit the nail on the head. The point is we made a lot of mistakes. And from the beginning, we were heavily criticized, and rightly so in many cases, about Iraq and Afghanistan. But there was underlying respect and cooperation. There was a knowledge and understanding that the U.S. made commitments, follow them, or made threats and follow them through. Now, under the Biden administration, and I can't say that it's solely the Biden administration, I think the shift started really happening under President Obama, continued under perhaps President Trump, and really under this administration, we have the perception abroad, which I think in many cases is fair, that we aren't as reliable for good or for ill as we used to be. It's very difficult for our friends and our adversaries to predict where we're going to go. If we draw a red line, to anticipate that we will stick with it. When we make a threat, to understand that it's a threat that we will follow through, or that if we make a commitment, we will follow through, even though at great cost. I think the perception of both our allies and our enemies, particularly under President Biden, has been that we're very difficult to understand. We're not predictable. It's very hard to ascertain where we're going to go and what our responses are going to be, or whether we're going to show up at all. And that's very dangerous.
When you invoke the red line metaphor, I recall very vividly when former President Barack Obama said that he drew a red line in Syria after Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons on his own people. And he said that that would be a red line, that we would act, and then we did not. There's no question in most people's minds that this was a signal, a very dangerous one. And I've heard some analysts say that that lack of enforcing the red line served as a green light to Vladimir Putin. So in 2014, some people think that he saw that as a green light to then invade eastern Ukraine and take over Crimea. But again, these are some analyses. And certainly these mistakes have multiplied over administrations. Former President Trump was seen as very unpredictable in many ways, very nationalist. And we're seeing some of that. I would agree with you with current President Joe Biden. There's so much attention on domestic issues and trying to bolster our economy. But at any rate, there's certainly, you know, differences of opinion on that. How would you grade, in a sense, President Biden's leadership on the huge crisis we're facing with Russia having reinvaded Ukraine last year? And to what extent is he leading well on this, having galvanized our allies? And we're going into the NATO summit, looking at potential membership for Ukraine in the coming years, perhaps. How do you see that?
All in all, I do not give President Biden high marks for his leadership on the Ukraine issue. And mostly my criticism would center around his lack of leading within the United States, frankly. The president has yet to address Ukraine and discuss its importance to the United States in a profound and enduring way. And I think it's very difficult domestically for the U.S. persons to understand exactly what we are doing in Ukraine. And there, I'm fairly critical. On the other hand, as you point out, the NATO alliance not only has held together, it has grown. We have one new NATO member, another on its way, perhaps two, with, of course, Sweden hanging in the balance, Finland having joined just a few months ago. And the big question of what's going to happen with Ukraine will come up in the next couple of days. So on one hand, very critical. I think the administration allowed the red lines, so to speak, to be drawn and crossed by Russia and Russia alone. We made a critical mistake in not providing Ukraine with more and more effective weapons early on and establishing air superiority and a humanitarian corridor in the air in particular with no-fly zones, as recommended by General Breedlove. I'm quite critical that this has become almost a war of attrition. Thank goodness that the Ukraine has done better than anyone could have possibly had anticipated or hoped for. And the Russians have done much more poorly than I think anyone anticipated. But to go through another winter with this war being where it is, I think is a travesty. And I put a lot of that squarely at Biden's feet on the one hand. On the other, we'll see what happens in the next couple of days. And we've got to have NATO countries step up even more. But overall, I think that's my assessment.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense, Mary Beth Long. We're discussing the major national security challenges facing the United States and the world. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, the Honorable Mai Jarma from Potiskum in Yobe State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our special guest, Secretary Mary Beth Long. And Mary Beth, we just talked about NATO in terms of the summit and Ukraine, the challenges it faces in defeating Russia. Mm-hmm. Are you in favor of Ukraine membership to NATO?
I am. As you pointed out earlier, this has been a long time coming. I don't think at this particular meeting in Lithuania that there'll be a vote with Ukraine joining immediately. I do hope to see a rapid or fast track approach that works through some of the issues that normally a roadmap to membership would normally face because of the extenuating circumstances of Ukraine being partly occupied by Russia. But I'd like to see a concrete, achievable path to Ukraine that then NATO gets behind, not only as NATO as an organization, but the membership.
And with respect to Ukraine, what do you think victory looks like, Mary Beth Long, with respect to the aggression from Russia in terms of territorial integrity? How do you see this ending in a success for Ukraine and for the Transatlantic Alliance?
As a personal opinion, I don't think that there is any way that Ukraine nor I would see our way through with Ukraine giving up any of its territorial integrity to Russia. That sends horrible signals to the rest of the former Soviet Union, the countries that are not only aspirant, but those who are already within NATO. And I think that's one of the reasons why, as you pointed out, the initial incursion of Russia into Crimea and that having been unaddressed was a problem and laid the path for where we are now. That said, as a practical matter, I think it's very difficult for President Putin, as long as he's in power, not to save face, at least by having something. He can't go into the next phase of this conflict with some kind of resolution that gives him less than what he at least entered into. I don't see the Donbass or the East being a territorial acquisition of his. And I think there needs to be a creative solution on Crimea that has that as Ukraine territory, perhaps portions or specific parts of it leased to the Black Sea Fleet or whatever the arrangements are with the Russians.
That's a very interesting proposal that you just made. Mary Beth Long. We shall see. But speaking of Russia and Putin in particular, what do you make of the turmoil in the Kremlin and the Wagner mercenary groups challenging of Putin's authority? An outright denunciation by Yevgeny Prigozhin of the rationale by Putin for the most recent invasion of Ukraine.
I think there's a bit of a distraction with Wagner right now. And so far, just about everyone that I've seen speak to it is, I think we're all running a risk of being wrong and not really understanding what's going on there. But as you know, the Wagner group has been both a boon for the Russian military, basically making more progress than the traditional military has early in the conflict, and sometimes in critical moments when the Russian military could not. And of course, we can't forget that Prigozhin is also one of the major propagandists for Putin and has been for years on the one hand. On the other hand, this falling out represents at least a power struggle in the Kremlin within and among perhaps the various formal military organizations, perhaps the intel services, Putin himself, and of course, Wagner. Secondly, I think it represents concrete evidence that once again, Putin does not have his fingers on the real data, the important data of what is going on around him. The fact that this was a surprise, the fact that at least Wagner appeared to believe that it had support within the Russian military and may have had. I find it very interesting that while temporarily apparently being confined to Belarus, there's report and some evidence today that he is in St. Petersburg, where he is apparently occupied or with some of his security forces and has received some of his weapons, whether those were personal weapons or those belonging to the Wagner group. I think the real question will be, will he be leaving Petersburg or Russia to return to Belarus? I'm betting 50-50 that it was a trap, and that's the end of Prigozhin. And as far as we are in the current form that he's in, the fact that he would be allowed back into Russia was surprising. I'm not willing to make a long-term bet on where this lies, but certainly it's demonstrated a miscalculation just about on everyone's part when it comes to Wagner.
Do you think it demonstrates a weakness on the part of Putin and his grip on power? And to what extent do you think it may also weaken the war effort and, you know, puncture his veneer of invincibility vis-a-vis Russians?
I think Putin has suffered several big wounds. The performance of the Russian military is the biggest wound. I think where the Wagner situation will fall, whether it's a fatal or deep wound for him, or whether this is just a blip on the screen, will really depend on what happens next. If Wagner continues to exist, certainly it has many operations that are ongoing in Africa, one of which the one in Sudan, from which it, by all counts, is gaining significant experience and treasure. If Wagner survives and Wagner leadership survives, I think it'll be difficult to tell because it'll be constant irritant for both the formal military and, I believe, for Putin. What will Putin do if he's decisive and Wagner leadership ends up dead or back into the fold unceremoniously, perhaps relegated to prison or a diminished position? Then I'm not so sure. But with him alive and out operating, albeit from Belarus, I think it's further evidence of Putin playing his cards in ways we don't understand. Don't forget, it's a long Russian tradition to have the military officers, the high-ranking officials, the intel organizations, and other apparatus of state security to be at each other's throat. And I think that's cultivated by Russian leadership and Putin, who is a former intelligence officer, as we know. That played well for him in allowing both the problems with the military to be blamed on some that were marginalized, although briefly, but also to allow Putin to appear that he was sitting on top of a pile. What happens next, I think, will be decisive.
No question about it. And you mentioned the Global South earlier. And of course, right now, Russia in Africa, whether it's Sudan, the CAR, Mali, via the Wagner group, which is very disconcerting, to say the least. I was wondering, do you think this is an opportunity for the United States to come in and change the narrative with respect to our African allies, whether it's South Africa that's sort of on the fence with regard to the war in Ukraine, India, Brazil, they have relationships with Russia. Could we exploit this in some way, given the recent turmoil and aborted mutiny by the Wagner group in Russia and exposing Russia really for what it is, which is just a revanchist and authoritarian power?
I think there is a vulnerability there. I think it could be overestimated. Anybody who's been following the Wagner Group, Blackwater, these other so-called companies, these civilian entities, China has its fishermen who are really becoming apparatus of the state. Anyone who's watched this, I think over the years, should be alarmed. I'm not entirely sure that countries are as alarmed as they should be, even with what Wagner is doing in Africa, where it's clearly exploiting the African people, African labor, African resources to the benefit of usually some local power broker or political aspirant to the detriment of the people themselves. I think the big issue with these kinds of organizations has to be addressed globally, and it's not really come up yet. Some people would say it's one and the same with Blackwater and other organizations, I would argue, but certainly the Geneva Conventions and our other global institutions and treaties and apparatus don't anticipate these non-uniformed irregulars, these green little men. And NATO and the UN Security Council, this is going to be the way of war in the future, and they've got to recognize it, and we've got to come up with some way to regulate it. For the global South, I think the bigger warning, the bigger red flag is the exploitation of these countries, literally everyone that you name, by China. The undermining of the critical infrastructure and the economies, and in certain cases, minerals and other precious resources of global South countries that will benefit China because of these so-called Belt and Road agreements that are horribly skewed to ensure that the Chinese government or Chinese businesses gain access and ownership of key infrastructure, if not mineral and other wealth. It's exploitation, nothing short of that. And there is where the United States has an opportunity to challenge China and others, including Russia, to defend those, to make clear how exploitive they are and to offer a better deal.
I'm certainly glad you brought up China, Mary Beth Long, because I was going to ask you about that. So let's turn now to China and the so-called reset that we saw with Secretary of State Antony Blinken's trip to Beijing, restarting this dialogue after so many years, 5 years, I think, in person. And to what extent are you relatively optimistic about this? Certainly, there a lot of concrete outcomes didn't occur, but the dialogue itself, some say, is promising. There may be a meeting between Xi Jinping and President Biden in November at APEC. On that same vein, as you said, to what extent is this a good sign? And can the United States try to exploit this, particularly in Africa, and show really what the Chinese are doing with their nefarious actions?
You know, I will give credit where credit is due. And I'm a huge advocate and consistently say that you can't negotiate with an adversary or a potential adversary if you're not meeting and talking. So I give that accomplishment to Secretary Blinken as well as President Biden. Kudos for reestablishing some basis for negotiating or at least dialoguing with China. That said, the bar is about as low as it can be. Very little concrete came out of Blinken's efforts, despite, I think, some real attempts to get something concrete going. I worry terribly that this administration gives way too much ground and many too concessions to China. I believe and take China and President Xi at his word that the Middle Kingdom is on a rise to regain its traditional role as a world power, if not the world power. Some of that will mean that the United States and others need to step out of the way, or certainly will not retain their primacy in the manner in which they've held it for the last decades. Given China's actions, though, I think it's very clear, and one need look no further than the Belt and Road Initiative to appreciate that China does not conduct itself the way the United States does. And there will be exploitive measures and exploitive activities and human rights violations and lack of concern whatsoever for the rights, the sovereignty, and the ability, for example, of those within the South China Sea to even use their own territorial waters for necessary fishing and other trade activities. A price will be paid for conceding ground to China. And the faster the U.S. and others agree at least on those issues and confront China and speak to her with one voice, the more progress I believe can be made through the kind of dialogues that the Biden administration and China apparently are seeking.
I don't think much progress was made on Taiwan, but briefly, are you concerned that China may make a move on Taiwan, and how soon could that be? Or have they been chastened?
They have not been chastened. If anything, I fear that our U.S. lack of decisive actions and statements, even within the context of reestablishing conversations and dialogue with China, offer opportunities or appeared to offer opportunities for Xi to exploit. Listen, I take, again, Xi and anyone who spent any time in China understands that every Chinese is raised with the concept, with the aspiration, with the goal, with the accepted truth that China as a world power, as the world power for millennia, will return to her rightful place. And to the extent that she has drawn a line in the sand and says, and Taiwan is part of that China, and that he will make that happen while he is both in office and alive, that's a problem, particularly to the extent that you believe that Taiwan has its own destiny to shepherd, and not necessarily in conjunction with Xi's plans or on the timing of Xi's plans. So it's a problem. I think it's going to come to a head, certainly in the next couple of years, if not already. I worry that depending on how the U.S. conducts itself in the very near term, that if we don't show strength and we don't show decisiveness, China will view that as an invitation so that it acts something very similarly to its actions on Hong Kong. And the next thing that we see is either overtly or internally driven takeover of Taiwan so that it becomes very Hong Kong-like and then becomes a de facto part of China with an increasing deterioration in its freedoms.
And as we close, Mary Beth Long, you had some harsh words for the Biden administration with respect to its conduct of foreign policy, but let's take a look at the alternative. We are coming up on the 2024 presidential election. We're looking at quite an array of Republican candidates, even former President Trump, who has been indicted many times. And it seems like every candidate is trying to out-Trump the other one, trying to be more Trump-like. And I think that's a byword for very insular, looking to, in a way, pull away from the world. How do you see, U.S. foreign policy? On the one hand, you have President Biden, maybe not doing quite as much as you'd like, as forcefully. And yet, on the other hand, what about the alternatives if the Republicans prevail, who have really shown themselves to be not terribly internationally oriented?
Those are great questions. You know, when I joined CIA and I started with foreign policy and intelligence, I always considered foreign policy and national security to be a bipartisan issue where bipartisan approaches worked best. And I, for the longest time, most of my life, considered myself neither Republican nor Democrat, because I do believe that these are issues that have to have national support from all parties. I fear, however, that national security and intelligence and military issues have become hostage to an internal divisiveness within the United States that's manifesting itself through a lot of party conflict. But it goes even deeper than that. I think the country's going through a sort of a reset in many ways that reflect this cultural change, societal change, and we're going to be divisive for a while, Republicans, Democrats, and there's not much one can do about that. While I was critical and am critical, many of the Biden administration leadership are friends of mine and former colleagues, and I have a lot of respect for them. But I do think there's a difference between respect and merited criticisms, which one could also make of any Republican administration. So I don't mean to appear to be partisan. But more importantly, the rest of the world is different. And it's really hard right now for the U.S. or any country to deal with what lessons we've learned from COVID. And that is a globalized world where we're all interconnected in ways that we had really not anticipated, with impacts on our health, on our environments, on our future as far as global warming is concerned, on our trade, on our supply chains. And that has resulted in a real voice from the global South about a lot of problems that have been around for a long time but are coming to a head. And whoever is running the United States, Republican, Democrat, or third party, has got to deal with that global South, with the changes that are occurring, regardless of who runs and leads the United States. And we've got to get on board with being a leader in those issues.
Mary Beth Long is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense. Mary Beth, I can't thank you enough for taking time to share your terrific insights on so many critical issues with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.